the abandoned classes, because they made huge sums of money for doing nothing.
So they favoured the Industrial Revolution, whereas if the Mandarins didn't, according to your interpretation of Needham. It's possible, the coal in England had all been under London. Would that have stopped the Industrial Revolution?
You mustn't ask hypothetical questions.
The reason I said it may have been that there was something like that in China. Maybe that Shanghai or something, or Peking, not Shanghai, you know.
No, the thing which stops it is it signifies a challenge to the existing classes. But in England it didn't, because they saw a source of loot. Great, get on with the coal mines, you know, it makes more money for us.
They were onto a good thing.
Royalties, yeah.
Yeah.
Per ton.
But if it had been under London.
Ah, you mustn't ask that kind of question.
Okay, I won't ask you. Let me ask you about Bob Bethel. You are kind of pro Coleridge and pantisocracy and all this kind of stuff.
Not pantisocracy, the other one. Coleridge had a theory that every street should have somebody who works professionally for non-material, non-market ends, like the happiness of the people, education, health, enjoyment, sport.
Like a poet, in
fact. No, he called these people the clerisy, C-L-E-R-I-S-Y.
Did he invent that word?
Yes.
Extraordinary.
Oh. Now, it's in American dictionary, but you won't find it in that dictionary. The shocking thing is, and we have rejected Coleridge. But not in America. He's very big in America and Canada.
I'd assume that clerisy just meant scribblers, really.
No, that's clerics.
For example, Gramsci, I think it was, had a thing about clerisy.
Did he? Well, he got it from Coleridge, because Coleridge invented the word.
He coined it. It was actually his word.
Yeah.
Like amplify.
And so suburban. I think that was somebody else.
And so, right, so Coleridge, that was Coleridge's contribution to it.
Well, I mean, lots of contributions, of course, but he was a tremendous plagiarizer. He pinched ideas from everyone, which is perfectly fair. He didn't acknowledge it, that's the trouble. He got into a lot of trouble.
Well, that's what you are, if you're a plagiarist, isn't it?
I think the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner is plagiarized. I've got the thing he got it from.
Really? Is it French or something?
No.
He just tarted it up.
It's by Southey.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
Okay, so much for Bentham. How about Blackham? You're interested in Blackham, right?
Blackham, I know Blackham. You mean Harold Blackham?
Yeah.
I know Harold quite well.
What is your opinion of... I mean,
he's still alive, he's about 90.
Typical humanist, would you say?
Now, Harold says, I belong to the Enlightenment. He is a typical Enlightenment figure.
For example, let me see, here's an example. Trust. Mutual trust has its conditions and is itself a necessary condition. Take it away and social bonds have no hold, and without them, no human existence.
That's right.
That's
a good 18th century value, isn't it?
Does that... do you end up with anything at the end of people like... I mean, one of the things, the trouble with humanism is that it doesn't say a great deal, in my view.
Humanism has failed because it's been successful. We're all humanists now, so it's not news anymore, is it? 90% of people don't go to church, so why bother?
Yeah, well, they don't necessarily vote Labour or oppose war or anything.
No, but they don't actively believe in God. They may have a suspicion of somebody around, you know, but it wouldn't move them to go to church.
So you regard humanism, you take the view of humanism as just an anti-religious thing?
Christianity was killed by the First World War. The battle on the Somme put an end to the church, really.
People couldn't take it seriously, you mean?
The English gentleman and the Church of England died on the Somme. Walk into those machine guns and die, you bastard. Walk, don't run.
You don't mean that it just wiped out the people who like the class who were going to staff, become vicars and so on? You mean that psychologically it
killed the belief of the working man in the English officer and gentleman.
Well, in the same way that Germans were supposed to have made not to believe bureaucracies because of Hitler. They no longer count.
The Germans have been transformed. They've had Bismarck, Kaiser Wilhelm, and Hitler. They don't want the nation state anymore. This is why they're so much better than we are.
Right.
You know, they've got 16 prime ministers and one chancellor, 16 parliaments and one chancellor, 17 parliaments, because it's the central parliament. But we should go the same way, you know, and we won't, because of this ridiculous tradition of centralised government going back
right.
to Oliver and as far as you like.
Okay. Anyway, so is there anything much more to say about humanism? Except that it's,
See, humanism was a word used to describe the Renaissance, equating the Renaissance with the rediscovery of Greco-Roman culture, following the revelations which came from the library at Constantinople, which was bought before, during, and after the Turkish conquest in 1453. So these volumes of Plato, which were unknown, were brought to Florence and elsewhere, and a whole flood of original antique literature was made available to the West. The rediscovery of that, together with the native invention of discovery of perspective in art, Petrarch's sonnets, and all the first school in Greek was opened in Italy in the year 1400. Nobody in England could read Greek. Nobody in 1400. And no Italians could either. The discovery of the Greek language, classical Greek, was a huge breakthrough. And of course the invention of modern architecture. And the whole is an extraordinarily complex story, you know, which I don't right. profess to understand properly. But humanism is the name given to that. And it's the trouble is, it's used in a different sense today. In 1932 or thereabouts, there was a big conference in America. And there they decided that the rationalists, the ethicists, the secularists, and all the other people who abandoned supernatural religion would call themselves humanists in future.
That's interesting. There was an actual conference to
decide. And they issued a humanist manifesto, and of course Britain followed suit. So in 1960s, we had the same traditions, the South Place Ethical Society, the Rationalist Press Association, the National Secular Society, and the British Humanist Association, all called themselves humanists. In the last 5 years, they've opened up a building, all have their offices together.
Yes, I know.
You know, it means
the other end of in Theobald Hall, isn't it? Yeah.
In the back end of Theobald Hall. And, so that's it. But
and they produce this logo, this sort of H, elongated H.
Yes, it's quite a good logo, actually.
I tell you what, yes, I tell you what. Except, did you read Joseph McCabe at all when you were younger? He was very
prolific. Yes, but he was an ex-priest who was moved by profound hate of the Catholic Church.
Did you accept his view that, I mean, there's this idea or myth, I don't know which it is, that during the Middle Ages, monks did a lot of intellectual work, but he thought that was, as far as I can tell, complete nonsense, that the only reason that Platonism survived was because they were imported from the Middle East.
Well, I mean, a lot came through the Arabs in the 12th century. That's certainly true, especially mathematics and philosophy. I mean, the Arabs preserved Greek civilization better than the Christians did.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, do you think it's a complete myth about monks doing anything intellectual apart from presumably...
No, there was a number of first brilliant monks.
Was there?
But surely that like was just... Like Duns Scotus, for example, and others who...
Yeah, but wasn't that just the Bible? It wasn't anything to do with...
No, they challenged the whole authority of the Pope. They laid the foundations of the state. The first book outlining the functions of the secular was written in 1323 by Anyway,
not Duns Scotus.
No, his colleague. Scotus was involved with him. Anyway, the theory was, yes. In the Middle Ages there were two huge political associations rather than parties, the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. The Guelphs supported the Pope, the Ghibellines supported the Emperor. But the Guelphs had a mandate from the Bible and the Church and the authority and history and tradition, and the Ghibellines had to find a mandate because they hadn't got one. And in 1323, the critical book was written by an Italian from Pisa, not Pisa, yes, well. And this laid down the notion that the emperor or the prince represents the people. And the people are the mandate of secular power, not God. So it was the people against God. Emperor and the people against Pope and God. You know? And so, you know, the whole switch of... They now had an ideology on which to build. And Machiavelli is the consequence of the original book in
1323. I think I know the person you're talking about. Doesn't begin with G.
He was principal of the University of Paris.
Guicci Ardini, wasn't
he? No. Ardini was a colleague of Machiavelli, an aristocrat. He looked down on Machiavelli because Machiavelli wasn't an aristocrat.
Quite right, too.
God, my bloody memory.
Don't worry.
Something of Pisa. That's the key thing.
Someone of Pisa.
He was principal of the University of Paris, a great scholar of the day, and he backed the German emperor against the Pope, you see.
Okay. Yes, right.
Or the Bavarian emperor.
Or at least that's the way it's always presented. Who knows? Calvin, let's go on to the next one. Calvin, a marvellous formula for rich businessmen. I read quite a convincing story about the history of Switzerland with showing all these burghers supporting Calvin.
Yeah.
Although I forget the reason. I'm not great interested in Calvin.
He separated church and state rather well.
Well, you did tell me that you thought he was one of the most important men of all time, mainly, I think, because of, you know, individualism, was what they regarded as individualism. There's a whole kind of hypocritical thing, isn't there? It's like the idea of competition in the modern world. You know, there are sort of 200 companies which control 3/4 of all the world's trade or something, and yet Everybody prates about competition. The same with individualism.
Calvin is very convenient authority because it says that you are, before you are born, you are chosen by God to be saved or to burn an everlasting fire.
Well, that's possibly not the central as people.
This is the central doctrine of predestination.
Is it?
Yeah.
Have you read all of Calvin's works?
No, I haven't. But I know that this is. Predestination is a central thesis.
What I was saying is that I, in this book on Calvin, published in 1950 by a French chap, Wendell, he said that this claim that predestination was a central doctrine was first produced by two people, Alexander Schweitzer in 1844 and somebody else called Ferdinand Christian in 1847. And this was repeated like an article of faith up to...
But what did he say with the central doctrine was?
I don't know. That's the other 5,000 paragraphs. I only mention that because, of course, it's very easy to get these stereotype views. I'm not saying it's not. I just don't know. But anyway, you consider him to be important because of individualism.
Oh, well, John Knox, was a Calvinist who believed in predestination, and he altered the whole course of history of this country.
John Knox.
Yeah.
You sure?
Led the Scottish Revolution and the launched Presbyterianism in England too, because he's very Anglophile.
In what respects he changed the whole history of Britain?
He said it's a sin not to kill your enemy.
Yeah, well, that doesn't prove that you... Just because he says that, that doesn't prove that...
But he united religion and politics in one thing, you see.
Hmm.
And in England after that, a church and a political party are the same thing.
Really?
Yeah. In the Civil War, there were no political parties. They're the... The congregations were the independents, which is Cromwell's lot. The Parliament was Presbyterian and ambivalent. The Royalists were Church of England, and the Levellers were Baptists.
And that state of affairs presumably unravelled. I mean, it didn't last like that. Perhaps with the Labour, with the Whigs and Tories or something. It kind of started.
Yes, well, it tended to last until the 1832 Act.
Let's discuss Christopher Hill. I've got him down next because it begins with C. Well, I've got my computer system here. A whole lot of stuff here about Christopher Hill. I was just reading through his, I checked up, I read through his talk, I think it was 1989 at South Place. He said various things. He said proposal to separate teaching from research is probably a disaster. I'm not quite sure what he meant about that. He also said that each generation of history, in my view, he's a bit, he's not as critical as people make out. Each generation of historians, you know, has its own thing and so on. Historians should ask new questions of the past, which I should say is, he doesn't seem to appreciate, in my view, that a lot of history is officially imposed, you know. Like, I take it that a Regius professorship originally, you know, Henry VIII was not interested in investigating abstract truth, was he? He wanted his historians to say that he had every right to rule. That it was imposed, you know. They weren't interested in independent thought.
That's right.
And I don't think that Chris Hill appreciates that. He seems to think that historians, you know, one of them comes along, they think as the best they can, and somebody else comes along and exceeds them, and so on.
Yes, but what they're governed by is grants, you see.
Yeah, I think that's more to the point, in my view. He said that the important thing was the emergence of history from below, and the examples he gave were E.P. Thompson and Rude, and also Keith Thomas, who apparently started looking at women. I don't know about that. He also said that writing history from below is much more difficult than from on top, which seems to me a bizarre judgment. I mean, you've got, he says that, of course, the documents don't exist. You have to kind of unearth, you have to piece together stuff. But on the other hand, you don't have the problem of trying to work out what the truth was behind the documents. Anyway, pre-PhD generation, he mentions Tawney, Trevor Roper and Stone. He thinks PhDs have some effect. In fact, he was opposed to them. He thought that somebody with general knowledge should be exempted from PhDs, as I understood what he was talking about. He thinks Oxbridge was opposed to nonconformists, and it was the nonconformists who learnt modern subjects and produced inventors who created the Industrial Revolution. You know, he thinks that he puts primacy on education, which perhaps it doesn't, can't really bear. I think also he's a bit...
Yes, I've got that lecture. I was present in the lecture. I met him afterward.
Well, let's go through these points. I mean, there are all kinds of things that he mentioned. The business about separating teaching from research is...
Now, that's a very important point. Mm. See, in Cambridge, where I lived for many years, the dons regard themselves as interested in research, writing books and papers. They have to give lectures as a condition of their employment, and this is regarded as a chore.
Yes.
Consequently, they don't regard education as a discipline in its own right, and they can't bloody well lecture. They read their texts, they don't raise their eyes from their texts. They're hopeless communicators, apart from the odd few who can be brilliant. But, you know, communication is a very important matter, and dons usually can't do it. I go to conferences of philosophers and so on, and they read every bloody word, and never look at the audience at all. No eye-to-eye communication, no proper use of the voice. And so Christopher is saying, quite correctly, that people should learn to teach. He's a brilliant speaker. He has a slight stammer, though, but he got over that more or less.
Right. When he says that there's a proposal to separate teaching from research, I presume this proposal comes from dons, does it? I mean, that seems like they would support that idea.
They're supposed to separate them formally, are they?
I don't know. I'm not sure what he was talking about. It was rather vague comment.
That would be the ultimate disaster.
Hmm. Anyway, what about this point about each generation of historians? I mean, well, it's a fairly obvious point. I just thought that he was a bit disingenuous, really.
No, each generation starts all over again. I mean, I'm shocked when I see book lists today that the ones I read are completely ignored from 40 years ago.
Don't you think that's unfortunate? I mean, a lot of these books were... are presumably quite good books, and unless they're... I mean, of course, people have a vested interest in promoting their own books, don't they?
Well, unfortunately, if you're not alive, you don't count unless you're a bloody genius.
Mm.
You know, it's all a question of pecking order, I'm afraid.
Do you think the emergence of history from below has, in fact, taken place? I mean, there's still...
Yes, Ale Morton was a typical case in point.
Sorry, who?
Ale Morton. You mentioned.
Well, right, okay.
And Christopher himself and E.P. Thompson all wrote history from below. I wrote my history of Newcastle from below, you see.
Well, that's
no prison to draw.
That's true as regards England, but there's still, for example, if you look at India, there's still, I think the history of India is still pretty much not gone into, isn't it?
Well, Gandhi wrote from below.
Did he? I mean, there was a chap in, somebody quoted by Chomsky, who said that the British in India had a record that made the, you know, that dwarfed the Nazis. I mean, I don't know how accurate that is. But there's very little. You see what I mean? I mean,
well, that's an absurd statement.
The way the mutiny was treated.
Mutiny was the most brutal act, yes.
Oh,
Thompson's father wrote the classic book, and it's never been republished. It ought to be available.
Mm. Okay. Anyway, never mind. Okay, nonconformist super. I think also that he puts more emphasis on class and so on. He projects it backwards a bit. I don't really believe that the inventors were all nonconformists. I don't see. Seems unlikely. I think a lot of inventors weren't educated at all in all these sense. But I mean, it's hard to know. Anyway, it's an interesting point here about Lollardy. Many members of the clergy were able to articulate in a more sophisticated manner lay criticisms of the irresponsible wealth and greed of the church. You see, from my point of view, the church deliberately held to itself a monopoly of education. You know, if you didn't want to be, if you wanted to be educated, you had to go through the church. And it's disingenuous to say that, you know, the clergy were a good thing in effect because they were able to articulate criticisms. You know, in effect, they had a monopoly on these things, and they allowed.
Well, I mean, you can't generalise. I mean, Cartwright, for example, who led the Presbyterian movement in England in Elizabeth's reign, was victimised heavily. And he was a leading scholar at Emmanuel College, Cambridge. And, you know, the leading in the English Civil War, each regiment had its own chaplain, and they were given a bit pep talk that might last 2 hours before a battle. You know, they're very important revolutionary people, some of these priests.
And they also, they sang hymns too, didn't they?
Yeah.
Psalms, metrical psalms and so on. Okay, Milton, Marvel and Bunyan. Interesting point about Bunyan. Oh, of course, Milton, he says, Christopher says Milton was almost narrowly escaping, hanged, drawn and quartered. So you should bear that in mind when you're discussing yourself. There's a point about Bunyan preaching. Okay, it was made, Bunyan was deemed not to be fit to preach. But there's an ambiguity about preaching, is there not? I mean, if you look at the, if you compare, I mean, there's a comparison by Wedgwood Benn, or Benn, of the BBC with the Church of England, you know, the idea of the vicars was, or parsons or whatever. So they should do their weekly, like a broadcast. They tell people what to think and who, what to do, and so on. And when they talk about Bunyan preaching, there's an ambiguity. He might have just meant doing something sort of harmless, like talking about biblical figures or something. But or he might have preached in the John Bull sense of being telling people what they should do, and it might not be what they were told to do otherwise. Do you see what I mean? What is this thing about Bunyan?
Well, Bunyan was an idealist.
I mean, his preaching would consist of telling people to break motorways or something.
I read his sermons, actually. I read Pilgrim's Progress, but I haven't read his sermons.
You see the point I make about preaching? There's an ambiguity in the word. It sounds as though, because of habits, it sounds as though it must mean something boring and kind of
Bible-orientated. No, you mustn't underestimate the preachers of the 17th century. They were men of tremendous passion and intellectual ability. And you have to remember that there was no press in those days. The sermon is the agent of communication.
Exactly, that's like the Beeb, or something like the Beeb.
Mm. And so, you have to shift your whole perspective and think of, you know, the church as being the means of communication in society. That's why the king felt he had to control it.
Yes, okay. And also why people like Bunyan presumably had to be controlled.
Yes, that's right. They might let loose something.
Right. Do you think that's... Do you believe in folk music? Do you believe in folk art? I don't know. It's hard to tell whether.
Well, unfortunately, in England, folk art's been destroyed. We've destroyed the English village 4 times in 500 years. You know, it's a shocking thought.
What are the 4 times?
Sheep destroyed it. Hundreds of villages were destroyed in the Middle Ages by the enormous spread of sheep farming. Sir Thomas More said, "Sheep are eating up England." It was true. So they were destroyed by sheep in the first place, huge enclosures. The monks and the secular landlords cleared the forests in order to provide these enormous sheep farms, upon which the Middle Ages wealth was based. And the second thing was the Enclosure Acts for 100 years, from 1750 to 1850.
Well, there were 2 sets of enclosures. Okay, the first lot were the sheep, were they?
Yes, but the first lot wasn't done by Act of Parliament, it was done by just driving the peasants out and taking their... They took the wastes, you see, they took the forests and the wastelands and the empty spaces, which didn't belong to anybody, really, and built these huge sheep farms. And the villages that were photographed from the air in the 30s, you know, all over Britain. You could see the outline of the villages in the cornfields.
When aerial photography was introduced, wasn't it?
So that was... Then the Enclosure Act wiped out the yeomen entirely. Industrialised farming, brought in steam engines to pull ploughs and things, made it a capitalist enterprise. And the average size of farm went from 30 acres to 250 acres, you see, which it is now.
So those were the 4 events?
And those, no, those were 2 events.
Those were 2 events.
The third one was from 1875 till 1940, when the steamship and refrigeration brought in cheap American corn, Argentine beef, Australian and New Zealand mutton, Danish eggs and bacon, And your agriculture was largely destroyed by cheap food.
And fish and chips, for that matter, as well. Or fish. Yeah.
And then finally, in the last 40 years, factory farming and contract farming. You know. You didn't have to have workers anymore. You just bring in the contractors and they do this.
What do you mean, like sheep shearers or something? Like a team of people?
Well, look at these...
Like migrant
these,
workers.
Hen batteries and these pig farming and it's all done on a huge basis like industry and contracting. You don't have to have machinery, you just hire people to come in and do it for you.
Yeah.
And there's enormous subsidies which distort. And now the set aside 15% of your land's taken out. So factory farming is, so the English village farm has almost been destroyed. That's four times. So what's left of folk culture? Precious little.
Very little. And the peasants, I mean, there's no national dress, no national costume, is there? As far as I can think of. I mean, most of them are fake, aren't they?
We ignore the flag, too, St. George, don't we?
Celts are fake, something.
I mean, last week was St. George's Day, everybody ignored it.
I've got here, according to Christopher, popular English patriotism has no day. He said that Queen Elizabeth's accession day, 17th of November, was a day of popular celebration. I don't believe in the Elizabethan golden age thing. I think that's propagandist crap.
Oh no, I think it's the Armada. You must not rest on the effect of the Armada. There's nothing like an external enemy to solidify people.
Yeah, but...
And the gunpowder plot, you know, they had an enormous effect.
Was Britain solidified by the First World War?
Yes, but very unfortunately, led the Treaty of Versailles in the Second World War.
Yeah. Okay, what else did you say? Page 23 is called Freedom. The history, interesting point about freedom, what it actually means. I think Isaiah Berlin wrote an essay on it with about 100 different meanings. Freedom broadening from, this is the way it's always presented, freedom broadening down from precedent to precedent. And the Angles and the Saxons and the Forest being specifically English. But then Hill says, you've got names like boors, villains, villains, clowns and rascals. So perhaps they weren't that free. It's a very simple etymological point. It doesn't actually tackle the question of what freedom actually means. He's just using it in a loose sense.
Well, there are at least 10 hundreds of 10 definitions of freedom. But the important ones are the liberal definition. Freedom is the absence of restraint, which is the free trade definition of 19th century liberals. The Marxist definition, freedom is the recognition of necessity, which is a scientific definition and limited to that.
Sorry, the what of necessity?
Recognition of necessity. And the Mumford definition, which I think is the most important, is freedom is the scope of the imagination.
Lewis Mumford, do you see?
Yeah. And Nietzsche and Blake.
Okay. Anyway, so Hill discussed freedom in a vague way. He also mentioned slavery and West Indians, because that's part of, they've reintroduced that, haven't they? And there's a kind of fantasy of the 18th century as being a... which, in fact, Dora Russell quoted almost everything from Bertie Russell, apart from quite a few good points, several good points. And she accepted this idea of the 18th century as being, people with salons discussing things in intellectual ways.
That's right. The gentry.
Well, bizarre, but I think. He had an interesting quote from Cromwell, taken from his parliamentary speeches. I don't know whether they had shorthand or something, but there were published speeches of Cromwell, and he said that he had this extract, which he said showed that he was suppressing Ireland on the basis of cost-effectiveness. Cromwell said something like, by the grace of God, this will cost you less. Have you heard of that? I know Cromwell is, you think there's a legend of Cromwell's depravity and unpleasantness.
Well, Cromwell didn't regard the Irish as human beings because they weren't Protestants. He made this complete distinction between the Irish and the Scots. You see. Against the Scots, he would be, I'll kill as few Scots as possible.
Did you know they were the same people?
Yes, because they were Presbyterians. They were Puritans. And he was himself a Presbyterian. So he wanted to deal with Scotland with a minimum of force, or short, sharp battle, to ensure their defeat, and then treat them tolerantly, because they were co-Christians. But the Catholics he regarded as animals. Wipe them out, if need be. Which he did at his famous massacres.
Yeah, there's anti-Cromwell feeling at the present day. I remember I was in Ireland a year or two ago.
Well, he's the most hated figure in Ireland.
It's curious how, I mean, I told this chap that in English history, the way it was taught in England, Cromwell was sort of hardly mentioned, or, you know, certainly not with any great antipathy, not a huge amount of antipathy. This chap seemed completely amazed. I suppose it's surprising, it's quite an adjacent country, but the history is, of course, taught completely differently.
The Irish are historically obsessed. The English are historically ignorant.
That's a fair comment, isn't it? I mean, they can afford the luxury of being, of not knowing about things, can't you?
That's right. If you're on top, you haven't got to think.
Same with Americans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Defoe, he mentioned then, there's this poem by Defoe about Europe voiding its offal or something, and, you know, this one about the true-born Englishman, 1703 or something.
Uh-huh.
And he quotes this poem, Christopher Hill quotes this poem, as though it's proof that Britain, in fact, did have a very mixed ancestry. That seems like nonsense to me. I mean, Britain's got surrounded by sea. It's more difficult to get to England than other countries. So I presume, however much immigration has been in Britain, there must have been more of it in places like France or Italy or something. You know, so that sounds like nonsense.
We're a mongrel people, you know. We're Anglo-Saxons, Danes.
Yes, you say that, but Normans. Presumably the same thing. Why should not the same thing be true in Europe? It's much easier to migrate around there.
Well, it is true in Europe.
Yeah, but it must be more so, I imagine, because it's more difficult to get to England. And I think it's fair to I imagine it's fair to say that it's something of a myth to talk about English mongrelism. I mean, England's been far less invaded than other places. If you look at Germany, I mean, you've had, you know, they lost to Sweden, didn't they? And then France, you know, Napoleon and so on. There were incursions all the time.
Well, the English identity is based on regions. I come from Tyneside. And Tynesiders regard themselves as a people apart, you see.
Yes.
Their own accent, their own traditions, their own values, their own methods, their own history, their own character. And it's the same true of Birmingham and Manchester and different parts. So we really are a complex of regions.
Well, isn't that a slight... I mean, these things didn't... I mean, Manchester and Birmingham were not important until they became important, were they? I mean, they hardly existed.
That's right, but they became important in the 19th century.
So the regions were invented then, roughly speaking?
Well, the regions, the regions go back to the seven Englands of Anglo-Saxon England, the seven...
Yeah, but, I mean, Georges as a separate thing must be more recent than that, because they didn't exist. I mean, Newcastle didn't exist as a major place.
Yes, Newcastle was a Roman foundation, and then a Norman foundation.
Yes, but it wasn't very important, was it? It's like saying that...
it was important. It was a bastion against the Scots. Like Chester. Against the Welsh.
Against the Welsh.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, Defoe and... he made a couple of other points. Christopher, Areopagitica, classic defence of freedom to publish. Milton, I think... I remember... You know, that's another one of these views that it gets handed down, like a meme, you know? It's a... Areopagitica, classic defence of freedom to publish. There was a little sentence in Chomsky somewhere that, in fact, if you actually read it, Milton doesn't defend freedom to publish. It's more about licensing. You know, if the stuff is approved of, it'll get a license. It's not really.
Areopagitica was really to do with divorce. You know, I haven't read it for a long time. So
you mean he extended? He wanted to get a divorce. And so
he wanted. A proper discussion of the divorce issue, and it wasn't forthcoming. So he wanted, it was very personal to him, because he'd fallen out with his wife.
And then he generalised it to the whole field of...
And he made certain generalisations. Right. It's a very able piece, but it's rather special pleading rather.
Yeah, exactly.
It is.
In other words, he wanted to divorce, and to make it look as though he wasn't being petty, he amplified this to cover...
The important thing was what the Levellers did. They broke the power of the Stationers' Company to license publications, you see, and they
how did they do that?
By just doing it. Right. So when the Long Parliament was created, the Long Parliament itself was dismantling these organisations, you know, like the Star Chamber and the Court of High Commission.
It must have been technologically related too, mustn't it? It must have been easier or less difficult to publish.
Well, the printing press had been around for 150 years by then, so it was quite easily available.
Yeah. Well, you need paper as well, don't you? I mean, that's
you need paper, but the power of the stationer's company was broken and not reasserted for a long time, you see. So
was that stationer's company a...
was licensed by the king to be responsible for all publications.
So it wasn't a guild; it was more like
it was a guild.
Yes, it was more like a censorship. It was more like
It was a craft guild.
Oh, right. It wasn't a bureaucracy. You're saying it was actually a. It was actually a guild.
It had the power to say yay or nay to publications.
Right. Well, that's not the same. I mean, I take it by guild. You mean people who, for example, make papers or.
Well, they would, yes. I haven't made a study of the stationer's company, but they were people who made and sold paper, I presume.
And did things like bookbinding, that kind of thing, perhaps?
Well, I can't tell you.
Okay,
fair
enough. Okay, I'm now to assume they were just...
But it was a company of craftsmen.
Fair enough. I would have guessed that they were just bureaucrats, but I don't know.
No, you seem to have a thing about guilds. Guilds are terribly important.
Okay.
You'll never understand... urban England, unless you understand guilds, but they're all small-minded, you see.
Yeah. Let me take you up on that. Okay, the reason... you look at urban England, such as it was, I mean, they're small towns, because these were... I mean, the point about a small town was that its whole economic function was to manufacture things, and typically it was by hand. You know, it was not sophisticated by modern standards. So you have hand looms and whatever it might be. Or
this is my book on Newcastle. Look at the card guilds.
Anyway, I just thought that stationers, it would have evolved that. You'd have people who make paper and people who do printing.
Anyone?
And
mysteries by trades companies. 10 mysteries, 15 by trades and 10 companies.
Oh, there are tinplate workers and stationers.
These are the people who govern Newcastle.
Goldsmiths, bricklayers and blasters. What are meters?
I have no idea.
Scriveners sound like...
Scriveners are...
Scribblers.
Lawyers, I think. Writers.
That's interesting, yeah. Yes, I... Okay.
This is 1826, isn't it?
Let me just read them out, just for the record here. Okay, Appendix 1. Mysteries, merchant adventurers, brackets, drapers, mercers, and boothmen, skinners, tailors, bakers, tanners, cordwainers, saddlers, butchers, smiths, and fullers. By adventurers, do you mean overseas? You mean it's just a word used to mean...
Adventurers are traders.
It doesn't mean anything particularly adventurous.
No.
Okay, by trades, which I presume are subsidiary trades or something, mm-hmm. that sense, yeah. Masters and mariners, weavers, barber, chirurgeons...
Surgeons.
Yeah, surgeons, and chandlers. I was just getting the CH.
Yeah.
I mean, they still use that initial, don't they?
Yeah.
Cutlers, shipwrights, coopers, house carpenters, masons, glovers, plumbers, pewterers and painters as one unit, joiners, millers, curriers, felt makers and armourers, they all go together, presumably to make comfortable armour lined with felt, colliers, paviors and carriage men go together, and slaters. Then we have companies, 10 of these, goldsmiths, bricklayers and plasterers, rope makers, sail makers, upholsterers, postmen, spelled with an A, which are fitters.
They're coal dealers.
Coal dealers. Mm. Tin plate workers and stationers, bracketed together for some reason. Meters, M-E-T-E-R-S. Porters and scriveners. Okay. It says here, in 1831, the Grocers and Spicers Company was incorporated. That's very interesting, actually, because, of course, there's in Parkinson and in other places, there's a list of professions, and they were all starting up at this time, weren't they? 1830s. There's a whole list of the watercolourists.
They were starting, they were winding up at that time. They started up in the 12th and 13th century.
Oh, these were winding up. Well, these were winding down.
Yeah.
The professions.
Well, the professions are coming up. That's
like
architects, engineers.
Watercolourists, yeah, dentists, a whole lot of people listening. Yeah, mm-hmm. Accountants. Well, that's spiffing, yeah. Okay, finally he says, there's a story about Ye Ken the New. Do you remember that story? Attributed here to his former tutor, the late A.D. Lindsay, where you've got...
Whose tutor? Hill's tutor?
Yeah, Hill's tutor, A.D. Lindsay. I don't know anything about him. I've heard this, you ken the new story in Russell. You've got a sort of fanatical Scottish preacher telling his congregation they're all going to sort of burn in hell, and they all say, oh, we didn't know this, forgive us, or something. And he says, well, ye ken the new.
You know now.
Yeah, it's a rather boring story.
So anyway, Lindsay was master of Babylon.
Was he really?
Yeah.
So that was Christopher Hill's lecture. I mean, I pick on that rather than any of his other books just because it was recent.
You must be careful about Christopher, because he's very, very bright. He's brilliant, you know, and he's almost always right. So be careful for your own sake when you lay into Christopher.
Okay. Let's got some other things here. By the way, what do you think of Liddell on the subject of historians and popular ones, or non-official ones? What do you think of Basil Liddell Hart?
Well, he was the man who first got onto De Gaulle and the origins of Blitzkrieg, and he himself put forward the Blitzkrieg theory and was ignored by the Ministry of War and so on. So he was rather embittered by this. He was the number one publicist about military strategy, independently of the army itself, for many years, famous figure.
He also wrote, he wrote a history of the Second World War, didn't he, the military side of it.
Yeah.
Which was very highly thought of, for example, by A.J.P. Taylor. He also wrote a book, I came across a little pamphlet that was written during called Why Don't We Learn from History, including very interesting stuff on forgery of historical documents by military people. You know, they'd say, he gave an example of a French general or something in the First World War who wrote in his official log, we're now retreating from the village of so-and-so. And his underling looked at him and said, but we haven't been there. And he said, oh, well, this is for poor l'histoire. He made it up.
Yeah.
So I thought Liddell Hart was exceptionally kind of sophisticated in taking documents.
He was a very able man indeed.
And he was not an official historian either. Anyway, okay. I just thought I'd introduce that as a small thing. Let me just, got some things here. 1648, this is what you said, 1648 is still buried, despite Christopher Hill's life work. I think I've got 1648 as the right date there.
That's right.
What happened in 1648?
Second Civil War.
Why is it special?
That's the time when the King's Court is beaten into the ground.
Second
Civil War broke out on the 1st of May in Wales. Cromwell went there immediately. King was imprisoned in the Isle of Wight, was he?
Charles the First.
Mm. And he was in the course of crushing the Welsh revolt when the Scots rose and marched into England. So Cromwell detached himself immediately, marched north, picking up troops as he went. And the Scots, he engaged in a battle in 1648 in October, I think, or the beginning of December, and smashed the Scots army, which never turned and fought. There were two battles, actually, over two or three days, and the Scots were destroyed, and they never picked up English recruits. But the Scots outnumbered Cromwell's troops considerably. If they'd fought a proper battle, they might have smashed Cromwell, but they didn't. They fought as a...
What was the point of the Scots rising?
They were trying to restore the authority of Charles I.
Oh, I see.
It was the Second Civil War.
Right.
It lasted from May till December, and then Pride's Purge took place on the 6th of December, and the Presbyterians were exiled from the House of Commons about 120, I think. And we had the purged Parliament, which then set up a Council of State, which was a coming together of the Army Council and the purged Parliament, led by Bradshaw. And that was the authority that imposed the trial on the King and cut his head off at the end of the following month.
So the importance of it is the regicide aspect, is it?
That's right.
Hmm. So that's...
Regicides were all those who signed the King's death warrant.
Yes, kind of. Were they bullied into it by Cromwell, or is that not really? It's probably not really known.
No.
I mean, I remember seeing a film about it in which Cromwell insists on them signing it.
Cromwell emerges as the mastermind, but the commander in chief was Fairfax.
What was the ultimate effect of the First Civil War then, if any? Did it just lead up to the Second one?
Contained the big battles and led to the defeat of the King, who surrendered to the Scots at Newark and was bought by the English and taken to the eventually the Isle of Wight. So the main civil war is between 1642 and 1646. Then the army destroys the various castles which the king had used to prevent them being used again.
Mm.
The king is in exile for 2 years, conspiring with his supporters in Scotland and Wales and in Parliament. And Parliament changes sides, you see. Parliament becomes royalist between 1646 and 48, and is led by the Presbyterians, and they try to raise an army to fight Cromwell, but they fail.
What is the, if you look at the Scottish Rising, what interest did the Scots have in Charles I? Why should the average Scot, you know, give a bugger?
Because he made them promises.
Hmm.
He was the biggest liar and hung. He promised anybody anything to get some support, you see, and then forget his promise afterwards. So he would promise toleration to the Scots. And of course he was a Scot. You must remember.
Hmm.
He was a Stuart. It was their royal house. He was King of Scotland, remember, you see. King of Scotland, King of England, King of Wales, King of Ireland. So, they on balance decided to switch sides. They supported the Parliament in the First Civil War, and the Navy changed sides as well. That's why the Navy is called Royal, and the Army is not called Royal. Navy changed side in the Second Civil War. Unsuccessfully, perhaps.
The Royal Navy,
Navy Royal,
Navy Royal. Why should Bunyan say, until you know this, you are to yourself unknown?
Because that's a very important quotation, which nobody else ever quotes except me. It means to say that we are based... If I ask the average Englishman, how did Parliament attain to sovereignty, he has no idea. If I ask who the first Prime Minister was, he still has no idea. The whole thing is kept dark, you see. We're not allowed to know our own history. It's not taught in universities. I was actually told by my professor, my lecturer, the next bit concerning the Revolution and Civil War, I will leave to you. I will not lecture on that period.
Hmm. I know you told me this before.
I was horrified.
Hmm.
I was left in the hands of the Marxists, but I was fumbling. Huh?
Do you have evidence that that's still true? Does Christopher Hill maintain that's still true? Because presumably he's still teaching those.
Well, I mean, it's Christopher Hill and all the disciples, of which I'm one, over the last 50 years, 46 years. No, 56 years. Have broken into that. So now there's a considerable dialogue going on. It's not quite as... It's not simple anymore, but nevertheless, there are no novels, there are no films.
That's true.
There's nothing on Cromwell of any seriousness. There's an American film, which is a shocker. I counted 36 mistakes in it.
Is that the one? There's a film with...
There's only one. That'll be the one. Should be called Cromwell.
With, what's his name? With Alec Guinness as James I, is
it? Yeah.
That was Charles I.
It's a bad film. We should have dozens of films about the English Revolution. Or we get a little loyalist things about...
It's just curious that despite the supposed, you know, like the national curriculum and all the rest of it, which is, and the whole history of historiography, as the way it's taught to British kids, that there isn't more on this. Well, but maybe it's not extraordinary. Maybe they just concentrate on the empire and things. And if you get hold of 1900 textbooks...
See, it's just suppressed. The English technique is to draw a curtain across it. You don't fight it, because that makes it, it gives it publicity. You just draw a curtain over it,
right,
silence.
It's suppressed because of the regicide aspect. You're not supposed to...
No, it is just because it exposes the whole of the property and basis of England.
Hmm. Why does it do that? I'm trying to... labour the point. Why does it expose the property bases of England?
Well, when Ireland rebelled in 1641, they put Ireland up for sale on the stock exchange. You can buy your acres in Ireland here. We'll send the army and get the land back for you.
That's what you mean. Imperialism in the proper
sense. And the king said to the Scots, you're going to have the Anglican prayer book whether you like it or not, and I'm going to send the army to enforce the prayer book on you. That's how it all began.
So it's not so much the property basis as the military.
It's the authoritarian basis. Mm. Yes, you will obey these laws. You will pay these taxes, or else we'll chop your head off.
Yeah, I take your point about the keeping quiet aspect. You're saying that if you approach a supposedly serious historian with questions like this, they'll just ignore them. They won't answer your letters or anything. That's the technique.
Well, presumably the technique is just to leave it out of the syllabus.
Right. Yeah.
This doesn't. I mean, there are exceptions now because there are plenty of Christopher Hill's disciples in our universities. So there are plenty of good exceptions.
Yeah. There's a Justin Owett talk at LSE recently. It won the Hobsbawm Prize. A chap called Justin Rosenberg. Quite a nice chap, sort of young chap. I think he started off doing English literature, literary criticism, or something, or sociology, and then drifted into economics. And he had a whole lecture on what he regarded as being missing. He said there are no great books in international relations. There's just a kind of idea that, you know, like a Darwinian thing, that nations kind of have to fight and, you know, and have no opinion, have a kind of suppress the rights of other people, that sort of thing. And he was a kind of vaguely Trotskyist, and his whole theory was that the new theory that he suggests is combined and uneven development. It's a phrase out of Trotsky. There's a whole bloody, unbelievably shallow stuff, in my view. I don't know if you take an interest in these kind of historian types of that sort. It's difficult to kind of, I mean, they don't fit in with what you're saying. Your stuff is all, you know, at least there's some. You know, I mean, it makes sense. It's in English, so to speak.
Yes, well, there's something in that statement. Well, there are certain very good, I mean, the New York Review of Books now is remarkably good on international relations.
Is it?
First class.
Has there been one good classic in international relations? One classic text?
Well, the revelations around McNamara, you know, and this kind of thing. And now the whole thing about the secret thing is out since this thing, Spycatcher, was written.
Right. By McNamara, you mean that presumably American papers have been released, and so the people write them.
Well, he's revealed how he was against the Vietnam War and why he was conducting it, you know. Extraordinary business.
Sounds like bollocks to me.
And the whole of the Khrushchev business, the secret speech, the revelations about Stalin, it's all coming out. And now, there's this extraordinary thing. Cold War International History Project from Washington. American scholars have now got access to Soviet archives, including the most detailed ones. And this is the correspondence between Khrushchev and Mao Zedong, you see.
Oh, really?
All detailed stuff, right from the archives.
Translated.
And this is, there have been seven issues so far, and that's six and seven.
The Cold War International History Project Bulletin. This is issues 6 to 7, Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, Washington, D.C., winter 1995. That's interesting. There's some Vietnamese writing here at the very top, and then Russian, Chinese, and whatever that is. Japanese, I suppose it would be.
It's mostly documents, and it's very remarkable because it's in a Stalin.
Well, here's the thing about Korea.
Mao exchanging. And and the top people, the forbidden archives, are all coming out in print. So there's a lot of first class material. But there is a point that we haven't had a mastermind to put it all together yet.
Mao Zedong. Yes, that's right. It's not just that, because you have to take account of the stuff that's not published as well, isn't there? Presumably. I mean, I don't think.
Yes.
It's a bit naive to believe all the stuff is going to be. It's all going to come out. I mean, it must have had secret. For example, military stuff is often there, is it? Presumably.
That's right.
I think you'd have trouble doing. Anyway, I mean, for example, Korea.
The thing I revealed about the Vietnam War is still not known to people. When I tell them that Britain started the Vietnam War, their mouths open and they're horrified. Then I tell them how it happened and they're astonished, you know. Nobody ever tells it. Even though it's been on the box several times.
I presume the same thing is true of Korea as well. I mean, that's kind of underplayed, isn't it? Because it was it was not.
That's in this document.
Yes, I saw a few things about Korea there. Let's get back to this current bit with Chris Will. Gerard Winstanley St George's Hill and so on, six communities. Fairfax broke it up. The law of freedom. I've got a copy of Win Stanley's. I don't know if it's got the law of freedom in it. I presume it's a sort of definition of freedom, is it, or description of what true freedom should be, or something of that sort. Is it possible to summarise?
It changed his mind, actually. I should do some work on this now, but I haven't. But he wrote two major works, you see. I've got them here. Wrong one. See, in the new law of righteousness, which is the first one.
That's also by Win Stanley.
Yes. Now that came out in my birthday. Good heavens! The 6th of January, 1648.
There you are.
Now this is
perhaps you're reborn. Perhaps he's reborn in.
Well, I am a reborn, without being occult about it. I'm not at home in the 20th century, never have been, and I belong to the 17th century, or the 12th century, or the 21st century, but I'm completely out of touch, this bloody awful world. Anyway, he puts forward a very outright theory in this first major work, but in The Law of Freedom later on, he accepts the state, and I need to do some more work on that, but it's a very important shift of opinion between the crushing of the second. You see, Cromwell and Fairfax crushed the levellers at the Battle of Burford in 49 and put the leaders in that Tower of London, where they drafted their second agreement of the people. But the second text on the freedom is written after the title page is dated 1652. But it's written earlier.
Right.
And it accepts the state and it thinks in much more in terms of reform.
By the state, I presume that's not quite in the modern sense. I mean, it must be a much smaller affair altogether.
Government.
Hmm. Would that be monarchical?
Well, it's just a Cromwell, you see. So it's thinking in Republican terms.
Right, yeah. Anyway, it's not usually read.
I must read that more carefully myself. I must confess I haven't done it properly.
Okay. Let me just go through another couple of things about Cromwell. We mentioned the business about the money science, cost effectiveness, suppression, and Cromwell auctioning Ireland in 1644. Is that right? 16?
No, it wasn't Cromwell. It was Parliament.
Oh, Parliament, right. Three grades of land. They sold lands they hadn't got 5 years before they got them back. That's what I...
Getting back in 49, yeah.
Right. And the levellers are more or less ignored. The Putney debates, also more or less ignored. Are they not? I think they were published in about 1940, weren't they?
They've been published, yes. That's a very, very important landmark.
I think I've got a year of publication somewhere.
That was just after the occupation of London. That'd be 47, I think.
Yeah, the debates took place. Yeah.
Church is still there. We go past it regularly. The end of the bridge.
Little Putney.
Mm-hmm. Had a big fire about 5 years ago, but they restored it.
And the debates took place inside it.
Yeah.
Quite extraordinary. I imagine most people don't know that. One would imagine. Okay. Well, there we are. That's the Irish Christian. English attitude. You said that. Let me just a little point here. We broke up the church. Thatcher broke up the Tory party. In this country, nothing lasts. Transience is our crime, because we're so empirical. And there's a kind of opposed view that the British never get rid of anything. Things like the House of Lords, or monarchy, or various institutions keep on seemingly forever.
By adapting them.
Yeah. Well, these two views. Do you agree with these views?
The trouble is we are an empirical people. We've been successful for too long.
By empirical you don't mean theoretical sense, you mean
just simply ask, does it work? You know? That's what the empirical thing is. Does it work? If it works, okay. If it doesn't work, drop it. So we don't ask questions in depth and we don't look ahead. We haven't got a theory. We haven't got an ideology. And in a way, this is a good thing, because McCarthyism never took here, you see. I was under serious danger if it had done. My professor wrote my reference saying that this Peter Duggan is a member of the Communist Party. So I said to him, "Professor, this will lose me any job in London, in England." He said, "Will it? Well, I must change that," he says. But he approved of me. But he was an arch conservative, see, Professor Byrne. Quite a famous conservative.
Byrne.
Burns. B-U-R-N-S. W.L. Burns. An authority on Peel and South America. Anyway, you know, McCarthyism didn't spread to England. We weren't...
Well, England wasn't as important as America. That's the Chomsky view, that America has more to hide or more to lose, more to gain.
Well, whatever the reasons was, it was terrible in America. You know, people, thousands of people lost their jobs in Hollywood and Fleet Street, publications of all kinds. Massive victimization. It didn't happen here at all.
Are you related? Can I just ask? I've just got this note here. There are a couple of famous Cadogans I came across scanning through my computer files. There's an Alexander Cadogan at the BBC. Was there any kind of relation?
He was in the Foreign Office.
Was he?
He was permanent secretary. He was a key man at Bretton Woods when I was in America.
That's him.
He was permanent secretary of the Foreign Office.
Any relation?
I don't think so.
How about George Henry Cadogan, 5th Earl? It's mentioned in Russell's autobiography, Volume 2. I don't know anything about him, though. I didn't look him up.
Well, I've got the family tree, and it's under dispute. I'm having a discussion with it at the moment.
Oh, I see. There's
I may be descended from the Earl's Cadogan in the 18th century.
The wrong side of the blanket, or a proper one?
No. Quite official. The Sir Hans Sloane, who founded the British Museum, and his daughter married the second Earl, second Baron Cadogan. And that's where I may have come from, but this is open to dispute. I'm not going to...
So there's a large statue of him in the foyer, isn't there? What do they call it? Of the British
Sloane.
Sloane, yeah.
Big marble thing. He looks very much like my father, actually. And it is possible that I am descended from him. But there's a mysterious possible break in the 18th century which I haven't got to the bottom of.
Just going to have a pee. Yes, it was filmed, it was made for a TV film.
What did it done?
With the brother of David Suchet, you know, the chap who plays Poirot.
That's supposed to be for this play.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. Under Russian Eyes, is that it? I think so.
No,
something like that. Well, Under Western Eyes.
Three words it is.
Under Western Eyes? It sort of promotes the view that anarchists are bomb throwers and that sort of thing.
Yes, and it's shallow conspirators. There's no idealism involved at all. It's just genuinely disgusting.
Anyway, and the point I was making about Conrad is that, as with Jane Austen, I remember one of his books, he talks about the racial inferiority of the Chinese. This chap with his almond eyes on. Maybe an arm-shaped eyes.
Did he know?
Yeah, racial inferiority. I mean, I don't know. It wasn't much.
That figures.
There wasn't much emphasis put on it. He was very pro the British Empire, wasn't he? He had a kind of childish adulation of a big military outfit. H.G. Wells disliked Conrad for all kinds of reasons.
Did he know? Good.
For example, he didn't like. He thought he was posing as a Polish aristocrat, and he couldn't take that very seriously. He also didn't like the way he pronounced English. You know, he learnt English without ever hearing it. And Wells said that he would say things like, "What shall we do with these are things? What shall we do?" And he disliked the way he drove around the countryside with his horse and cart thing.
not very sound reasons for disliking. In fact, H.G. Wells discovered, was one of the people who discovered Conrad. He was
where does Wells make his remarks? You know?
It's his autobiography.
Yeah.
I could give, lend you my copy. 1934 was his autobiography. But,
you
know, Wells,
you was, to play with him.
Wells was doing book reviews, and he reviews. He found, you know, he's given. You know how they gave him packets of books, and he had Almayer's Folly, wasn't it? And you know, Wells gave it a good review, so he helped actually promote Conrad. Although I think he regretted it later. He thought that Conrad was given too high a place in English lit, you know, sort of thing. Presumably for the reasons we're discussing. I presume it was not coincidental that.
Well, I haven't read The Heart of Darkness, have you?
No, I've got a copy of it. I found him, yes, it was quite an amusing day. Have you heard of a chap called Drinkwater? I mean, he was popular in the 30s.
John?
Yeah, he edited an outline, well, based on Wells, it was an outline of literature. And there was a kind of comment in that about Conrad, which I can't remember the wording of. He said how tiresome it was that this, you know, Conrad's chosen form is to have somebody discussing somebody else, talking about somebody else. I mean, it's very difficult to work out what's going on. You know, like a campfire yarn where somebody's retailing a sort of second-hand story. What did you work out about Ireland, anyway? What's the what's the secret story?
John Hume is the menace.
Is he?
He conned everybody. Adams, the teacher, Major, Clinton. Amazing.
Is there any hidden agenda going on there? That, people don't. What about the possibility of Ireland being used as a base against Britain? You know, used to be, or England, that used to be a big thing, didn't it, before the First World War?
That's the old theory, yes, since the Spanish landed there in 1601. But that's over now, because the French, the Spanish, and the Italians, the Germans, hitherto regarded as the possible exploiters of Ireland, as the backdoor attack on England. That's all over. The government says quite rightly that Ireland is no longer of strategic importance. And that's good news.
Do you think Northern Ireland was created for economic reasons, so that Britain would control the Belfast shipyards, which were then an economic asset? So you design a little bit of country to contain, you know, to be as big as you can, as big as it can be consistent with.
Part of the empire is a sort of loot.
Yeah, but when Northern Ireland was
rent rolls.
When Northern Ireland was chopped out for time.
Oh. He's done to forestall a civil war. There's no way the Protestants were going to accept the unification of Ireland. No way.
But was that for economic reasons?
No, political reasons.
What were the political reasons?
Home rule equals Rome rule.
Well, that's not exactly political, is it?
It is.
Was it?
Dublin was seen to be the agency of the Pope. Rightly or wrongly. It's the question of who governs us. They weren't going to accept any.
Do you think average Irish people were, in fact, in any serious sense, Catholic?
That's an interesting question. I think the answer is yes, but why? Because, according to my information, the Catholic Church nearly died out in Ireland. in the 16th century. But it recovered as a means of resistance to English conquest.
So that's not a belief thing, is it? That's more of a power thing. When people ally themselves with the church, to, as far as I mean, I don't imagine the peasants had much influence or choice or anything. But I mean, that's nothing to do with belief, is it? That's just a kind of pragmatic thing.
Well,
I don't know. I'm just asking. Why is it that, on the face of it, it might have been possible for England and Ireland to be on friendly terms?
It's possible now, provided we transcend the past. Either do that or have a civil war. The big new idea is the Confederation of British Isles.
Well, isn't there one already?
No. It's New Ireland. Including the Republic. The book coming out in October about this. New man's appearing on the scene, Richard Carney, University of Ireland in Dublin.
Or Trinity, is it?
No, not Trinity. That's a Protestant foundation.
That's right. I mean, Dublin was largely Protestant, wasn't it?
Protestant city, yeah.
I sort of find it puzzling that why should that people should want to risk civil war, then kind of amalgamate with the same what's essentially the same country.
Culture clash.
But you think it would not be beyond
there are two peoples, planters and Gaels. They don't mix and can't mix.
But since the Industrial Revolution, planters have been in the, at a discount, haven't they, really? If you look at the presumably the Belfast shipyards were a major, like with, you know, Scotland, Clydeside, in the 20s and 30s.
Done by planters entirely, isn't it? Catholics banned shipyards. Total ban.
They have.
Have you been over there?
Yeah, sir, a few times. I was struck by how Europeanised it is now.
Yeah.
There are areas near with archaeological remains on the, I think it's called the Dingle Peninsula, or something, on the west coast. Southwest, you know, the bit sticking out and tapers off into the sea. And there are, well, you know, I mean, there are you get the occasional straight road built by Trevelyan for, you know, a penny a day or something. But now you get EEC things, you have the European, you know, it says something like European Community Project, and they have sheep or whatever it is, you know, on land, which probably doesn't, isn't really good.
They've done marvellously well out of Europe.
Yeah.
Marvellously. Much bigger grants than they had in Northern Ireland. Because they worked at it systematically. They get every penny they could. And of course, agricultural policies worked their way too.
Saying, I mean, the Tories and the Conservatives in Germany are supposed to have, you know, one of their supports is large agriculture interests like in, you know, East Anglia and Bavaria, and I suppose in France, you know, the Champagne territory or something like that. Yeah. So you're saying that Ireland happens to resemble these places, and they couldn't draft a policy to benefit agriculture without sort of including it by sort of default, really. I can't believe it was deliberately designed to benefit Ireland.
No, all that is being said is that the Irish government took the European thing very, very seriously and worked at it in a way the Northern Ireland office never did.
They knew what they were doing.
And they maximised every squeeze, every penny they could.
Yeah, but the fact that was possible presumably was due to the fact that agricultural interests are regarded as an important thing. I mean, I was going to ask you, the next thing I was going to ask you about was international food production and all this kind of stuff. Very thorny issue, really.
I don't have anything about that.
Hmm, well.
Want some more bread and jam?
No, I don't think so. I'm trying to lose weight, actually. Couple more of my bits of fruit.
The millions who make the world's wealth decide to seize it and use it to fashion a system which needs rather than profit determines others. I mean, how can you handle that notion that millions have got to act? You know, it's ridiculous.
So, what does that mean?
It means there'll be nothing. Nothing will happen.
SWP.
Yes, so no Nigel, commitment to doing anything at all.
So that's Nigel Harris.
Yeah.
And you know him.
Yes.
You helped set up.
I helped set up the organisation.
Which organisation? You mean the SWP?
SWP.
Oh, right.
It used to be called International Socialism. I was on the editorial board and wrote the first article in the first issue.
What do you think of Paul Foote? He's there.
He came much later.
Is he an important part of the organisation, would you say?
No, he is. He wasn't then. He was... Tony Cliff is the key man. There's his brother-in-law, Mike Kidron, but Kidron's dropped out. He's now a professor on the South Bank somewhere.
Isn't Tony Cliff a Jewish chap who changed his name?
That's right. His real name is Egale Gluckstein.
You see all the stuff here about... There's so many issues, actually, up there. I suppose there are... Where do you start? You know, there's the things like there's this sort of McDonaldization of places where you have where land is grown. It's not so much raw materials. It's like raw material. You know, with Marx, you've got various exploitative mechanisms. For example, markets and raw materials. It's easy to overlook cheap labour is another thing, isn't it, these days? Super cheap labour, like in Haiti or something. And also, but there's also just the use of land to grow things and then export it. It happened in Ireland during the Irish famine, didn't it?
Cash crops.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't call it cash crops exactly. I don't know that. It's a different thing. With the McDonald's
it might be copper in Zambia, as you mentioned, though. Or groundnuts or whatever, oil.
Or cows. There's also this business about dumping and so on. Have you managed to decipher what happens with dumping? Because on the face of it, it seems an absurd kind of thing.
It's all about how you handle the insoluble problem of surplus, which everybody runs away from. This is why I'm on about the gift economy all the time.
Can you explain that? Because this is a serious issue.
It is absolutely fundamental issue. The fact is that our system is based upon scarcity. Scarcity is a 12th century invention.
Why do you date it to the 12th century?
Because that's when the market was invented.
What makes you say the market was invented in the 12th century?
Because they discovered there's a mint of money in sheep. Previously, people kept a few sheep and spun their own yarn and woven their own clothing. And suddenly the Cistercian monks find out there's a bomb in sheep.
When you say market, you mean the market on the...
International scale.
Huge scale.
And then they level the forests of Europe, especially England. To build these huge farms of 10, 15, 20,000 sheep in a flock. Huge.
How were they kept together? I mean, how were they fenced? What did they bother?
They were just the fences to surrounding forest. Keep out of forest, no grass.
So that was the start of Adam Smith and so on, was it?
Yes. The market is a 12th century invention. And the first Lord Mayor of London is appointed in 1291, as he were 1191.
What about the idea of trade? You know,
that's again a 12th century invention.
What are they called? These countries in the north.
There was the Scandinavians. The Danes had a certain trade. That's why Leicester and the towns of Middle England were created by the Danes. And there was some marginal trade invented in the Anglo-Saxon period. didn't govern the whole country, and it wasn't central to the economy.
Well, the Romans had international trade too, didn't they?
That's right too, but they all were wiped out.
Mm. So what is the overview that determines
the overview is that the medieval structure. System originally was based not on money at all but upon services. The peasants gave labour services, the knights gave political and military services, and the monks and priests gave religious and cultural services, and there was money which didn't come into it. You worked on your land and you spent more than half the week working on the demesne land of your landlord for nothing. In return for that, you worked on your own land for a couple of days a week, and they all had their strips or patches, and there was no money involved at all. It was a subsistence economy. People don't understand that the ownership of land didn't happen before the 12th century. Land was a collective responsibility. It was carved up periodically between members of the family to ensure equity. When the Anglo-Saxons first arrived here, they had all the land they wanted, so they said to each other, how much land do you want? How much can you work? And they settled on 120 acres. A hide. That's the basic land grid. And a quarter of a hide is a vergate, 30 acres. You can't work 120 acres, too small, too big for a family. So it came down to 30 acres, which is the basic holding in the Middle Ages. No money involved at all. It's conquest, carve-up, and sharing.
Hmm.
Along come the bloody monks from Citeaux in France, and where Cistercian comes from.
Hmm.
And then the secular knights called the...
Teutonic Knights?
No, they're called the... Anyway, the ordinary knights get the message, copy the monks, and start to build sheep farms in the 13th century. Become wealthy. And in 1252, a very important law is passed by Henry III. All landowners owning land worth so much a year shall become knights, whether they like it or not. Not a question of honours or ranks. If you're a knight, you have certain obligations to the king. The king had a nouveau riche class in Simon de Montfort's time, which weren't under his rules, because they'd made a bomb out of sheep. So he made them all knights, which made them all... Then they had to pay shield money, you see, in lieu of military services, and came under the wardship laws, if their children were orphans. So he... And then, at the same time, land became marketable. Having become valuable as an agency for making a bomb out of sheep, it then began to be bought and sold. The buying and selling of land, leasehold and freehold, begins in the 13th century. Didn't happen before then. Nobody wants to know about this. But George